From his place at the ship's railing, Olaude Equiano looked out over the vast ocean at the tiny green dot on the horizon. After so many weeks of pitching and rolling on the Caribbean Sea, suffering fearsome gales and sudden downpours and violent swells that threatened to capsize the sloop, land had never looked so appealing. Even if that land was the island of Montserrat, a sugar-planted colony of the United Kingdom whose ways and masters he would prefer never to meet again. Still, Equiano would gladly choose that place over additional weeks at sea. Equiano's nostrils were full of the salt smell of the ocean and the tar coating the ropes that held the mast and its sails in place. He heard the mate calling out to the sailors aloft, shouting at them to reef the sails. A new wind threatened to push them off course. The ship's bell clanged, marking the change of the watch. The captain spoke in inaudible tones with the vessel's navigator near the ship's wheel, calling for minor alterations to their heading to bring them directly into the port of Plymouth. As they approached the island, it resolved in their eyes from a smudge into the rising bulk of the volcano that loomed above the port town. Equiano did sums in his head while the crew brought the ship into port, calculating the value of the goods he was due to sell in Montserrat on behalf of his master, Robert King. He adjusted the sale price and reran the numbers, as he had dozens of times on the voyage from Georgia. It would be enough. It would have to be enough, he told himself. King had promised Equiano that he could one day buy his freedom. Now, 3 years later, Equiano finally had enough money to pay King his sum. He didn't dare hope too much. Equiano had been disappointed before, and he knew that King wouldn't willingly part with a good worker, not without raising a hue and cry. In such a dispute, who would aid the slave? He had learned the answer to that question the hard way, many times over, during his decade of enslavement. But now, Equiano had someone on his side. The captain of the sloop, with whom Equiano had worked for years, and who knew Robert King well. Fidelity to his word couldn't bind King to his promise, but perhaps the shame of being judged a poor Christian by a fellow white man might make the difference. As the sloop hove into the harbor, sails now fully reefed, Equiano allowed himself a moment to think of the future. What would he be if he were no longer a slave? Who would he be? Could he return to Africa, perhaps even find his long-lost sister, who had been abducted from their village with him all those years ago? Perhaps not. But he would be free. The open waters of the Atlantic called to him, and so did a better life, one in which the whims of Robert King or any other master couldn't force him to work and suffer on their behalf. Freedom beckoned Olaude Equiano, and he was determined to seize the opportunity and never let go. I'm Patrick Wyman. Welcome to Past Lives. It's hard, given all the terrible things in the world, to not be cynical. Concentration camps, starving children, genocides, the rolling back of women's hard-won rights, the impunity of the powerful despite widespread knowledge of their monstrous crimes. All of these things and many more can give us the impression that the conditions of our world are inherently bad, perhaps even irredeemably so. We question whether there's anything we can do to make it better, to right wrongs and create a more just world for ourselves and for our children. But the next time you start to feel yourself beginning to succumb to cynicism, as understandable as it might be, I want you to think about Olaude Equiano, the life he led, and the lessons he took from his experiences. Olaude Equiano was known to most of his contemporaries as Gustavus Vasa, the name his master forced on him. Equiano, for his part, never let himself wallow in cynicism, despite bearing witness to the absolute worst of humanity. His abduction from home, the cruelty of the Middle Passage, and the awful fates that befell so many enslaved people, Equiano retained his identity and used his outrage to fuel his foundational belief that the world could be improved. His autobiography, The Interesting Narrative of the Life of Olaude Equiano, is one of the most powerful and moving works ever written. It was intended to be a direct challenge to the racist, exploitative beliefs underpinning the mass enslavement of Africans and an expose on the mountainously inhumane conditions enslaved people were subjected to. In all of that and much more, Equiano succeeded. His autobiography became a foundational pillar of the abolitionist movement. Within 2 decades of its publication in 1789, the slave trade was outlawed. 25 years after that, slavery in the British Caribbean was abolished altogether. In the wake of this seismic event, thousands, if not millions of people who might have been packed into floating prisons for punishing, months-long voyages bound for agonizing lives of servitude, never left Africa. In England, British members of Parliament, who had never before considered the root source of Liverpool's incredible prosperity or the vast wealth of the Caribbean sugar planters' lobby, suddenly found themselves forced to grapple with the brutality and scale of the system that enriched a few at the cost of so many. Others plugged their ears or tried to justify the viciousness Equiano so eloquently described. Some of them, not all, but some, followed their moral reasoning to its defensible ethical conclusion. The slave trade in particular, and racialized chattel slavery more generally, were no longer compatible with what the United Kingdom believed itself to be. Now, Ola Ude Equiano wasn't solely responsible for sparking this particular revolution, and nothing could erase the horrors of the Atlantic slave trade or bring true equality to people of African descent living in Barbados or Jamaica. But those reforms, and Equiano, mattered. Today, we'll follow Equiano's long, trying voyage from West Africa to the Caribbean, the Americas, England, and the far reaches of the Atlantic. He'll be our guide, the best guide we could ever hope for, to a world of violence, greed, suffering, and resistance, above all, in response to a system and an ideology that dehumanized and brutalized millions of people for centuries. A quick note on sources. I'm relying on Vincent Carretta's biography of Equiano, entitled Equiano, the African, Biography of a Self-Made Man, throughout today's episode. But the fundamental voice we hear today is Equiano's own. Read the interesting narrative of the life of Ola Ude Equiano if you ever get the chance. So let's start by getting to know Ola Ude Equiano. By his account, he was born around 1745 in what is now Nigeria. Around age 11, he was kidnapped, transported to the coast, sold into slavery, and placed on a ship that would take him through the Middle Passage and across the Atlantic. He went first to Barbados, then to Virginia, where he was purchased by a lieutenant in the Royal Navy, and then traveled to England. Serving as the naval officer's valet, Equiano participated in major battles of the Seven Years' War. He was sold again, returned to the Caribbean, experienced yet another sale, and was finally able to purchase his freedom in 1766. Once freed, Equiano became a sailor, traveling the length and breadth of the Atlantic. He even participated in an Arctic expedition in 1773. By the 1780s, he was living permanently in London, where he became increasingly involved in the nascent anti-slavery movement. His autobiography was published in 1789, transforming him into one of the leading luminaries of the abolitionist cause. He married an English woman in 1792, had two children, and died in 1797, aged around 52, leaving a substantial estate to his heirs. It's impossible to separate Equiano the man from Equiano the story and image. One of his modern biographers, the literary scholar Vincent Carretta, argues that few people in all of human history have more of a claim to being a self-made person. He began his life in a village in West Africa and ended it as a prosperous author and family man in England. That was almost entirely his own doing, the product of his immense talents, personal drive, and sense of justice. His ability to pick and choose the right images and words to convey the core truths of the evil he witnessed is masterful. This is, however, also a concern for a historian using Equiano's autobiography as a source. The better an author is at weaving together a story and defining themselves and their role in that story, the less obvious their authorial persona tends to be, and it gets harder to recognize the artificiality of that story. I don't mean artificial in the sense that the events didn't happen, but more like crafted in the way that authors pick and choose which details and events to emphasize and which to leave out or minimize. Bad writers leave gaping holes. Good writers don't even show the seams where they've stitched things together, and Equiano is as good as they come. Because of that, the process of self-crafting in the narrative is subtle, almost hidden. It's far too easy to take it all at face value, and doing that would be a disservice to the sophistication of Equiano's style and to his literary talents. According to Equiano, he was born in what is now Nigeria, in a village today called Iseke, in 1745. I say according to Equiano because while most historians accept his account, there is some doubt. After publishing his interesting narrative, Equiano was accused of falsifying his African origins, a charge he contested strongly during his lifetime. That specific accusation of having been born on the Danish island of St. Croix was spurious, but other questions remain. When Equiano was sponsored for baptism in England in 1759, his place of birth was recorded as South Carolina. A ship manifest from 1773 likewise lists his place of birth as South Carolina, while other African sailors on that voyage were explicitly said to come from Guinea and Madagascar. On the other hand, though, there is a village named Iseke in the Igbo lands of Nigeria, and Equiano says he was born in Isaka. There was still a family with the surname Ekweoluo living in Iseke in the 20th century. For these reasons, I tend to think Equiano really did come from West Africa, but why he chose on two separate occasions to say he was born in South Carolina, we simply can't know. Wherever he came from, Equiano's descriptions of village life in West Africa are perfectly consistent with what we hear from other sources, and whether his life story is actually his or that of well-informed people with whom he spoke, it doesn't really lose any of its power or moral authority. Equiano's life story begins among the Igbo in Isaka, where his father was a respected elder, his status marked by ritual scarification on the forehead. The word Equiano uses for that group of elders is embrenche, a rendering of the Igbo word emburichi, meaning men who bear such scars. This is one of many aspects of life Equiano claims to recall from his youth. He talks about the modesty of the women in his home country, the concern for purification, the central role of singing and dancing, methods of building construction, religious life, his childhood of throwing javelins and shooting bows. We know that the adult Equiano filled out this section with details from a known published account of West Africa, although the author himself never mentions it. This was common practice in 18th century writing, and it's entirely understandable that he went looking for more information to fill out his account for English readers, considering he left when he was a child. In his words, quote, "Such is the imperfect sketch my memory has furnished me with of the manners and customs of a people among whom I first drew breath." In light of that, I think a little caution on our part is understandable. Equiano's life was idyllic until he turned 11, shortly before he was due to receive the same ritual scarring as his father and elder brother. One day, while the adults were out working in the fields, two men and a woman scaled the walls of their village and snatched Equiano and his sister from their house. Before the children could raise the alarm, as they had done in previous instances of kidnappers coming to the village, Equiano and his sister were carried off into the forest. He never saw Isaka or his mother and father again. Equiano was first sold to a goldsmith not too far from the Igbo lands of his birth, and the circumstances of his enslavement weren't too different from his life at home. After his second sale, however, he was taken to the coast for sale to European slavers. A brief reunion with his sister, who had been kidnapped with him, was cut short when she was once again ripped away from him. He never saw her again and spent the rest of his life wondering what fate befell her. On his long overland trip, Equiano was particularly struck by one group whose members scarified themselves, filed their teeth, and used swords and crossbows, weapons he had never seen before. West Africa was an extremely diverse place, and the wars between different groups were the primary source of captives for the transatlantic slave trade. Others, like Equiano himself, were opportunistic finds, funneled from lands far beyond the African coast into the trade networks that eventually brought millions of people to the Americas. The first object which saluted my eyes when I arrived at the coast was the sea, and a slave ship, which was then riding at anchor and waiting for its cargo, Equiano writes. That ship would be his home for the long weeks of his voyage across the Atlantic. Unlike the vast majority of the newly enslaved people who suffered that same fate, however, Equiano was later able to recount the true horrors that awaited him. Between the 16th and 19th centuries, more than 12 million people were transported across the Atlantic in slave ships. They were loaded into sweltering, stinking holds at hundreds of points of embarkation along thousands of miles of African coastline between Senegal and Angola. Nearly 2 million of those involuntary passengers died in Africa even before they ever stepped foot on the deck of a slave ship. Roughly the same number died en route in the Middle Passage, their corpses tossed overboard for the sharks that followed ships in anticipation. Another 1.5 million would perish within a year of landing in the Americas. Put another way, in the words of historian Marcus Rediker, roughly 14 million people were harvested in Africa for a yield of roughly 9 million long-term enslaved laborers in the New World. Rediker writes, quote, "The numbers are more chilling because those who organized the human commerce knew the death rates and carried on anyway. Human wastage was simply part of the business, something to be calculated into all planning. The people who owned and operated these vessels and profited from their voyages were extremely numerate. They understood that every death was a loss in the ledger. They simply didn't care." Equiano experienced the slave trade at its absolute peak in the middle of the 18th century, when hundreds of these ships set out every year, carrying thousands of captives to new lives of servitude and thousands more to an early grave. The Middle Passage wasn't just a voyage across the sea, and the slave ship wasn't just a ship. It was a floating prison, a factory run by a tyrannical captain overseeing a viciously disciplined workforce that took in free people as raw materials and churned out a commodity, enslaved African bodies. What separated a slave ship from a common merchant vessel was a structure known as the barricado, a purpose-built wooden rampart built across the ship's main deck to separate the enslaved from the crew. Netting suspended over the side of the ship caught captives who attempted to jump overboard. Chains rattled, clanked, and chafed in the hold, which reeked of excrement, vomit, and disease. It was worse near land when the captives were locked below to prevent escape. Packed together shoulder to shoulder to maximize cargo and therefore profits, there was barely enough room, Equiano reports, to turn over. Quote, "The shrieks of the women and the groans of the dying rendered the whole a scene of horror almost inconceivable." These ships were floating prisons to many of the sailors who crewed them. Very few, if he had any other options for employment, willingly signed up to crew voyages to West Africa. Violence was the glue that held the slave ship together. Violence directed by the crew with the enslaved cargo, and violence from the captain toward the crew. The captain was simultaneously a skilled craftsman, trader, boss, jailer, and the first master that his prisoners would experience. Violence was the tool the captain wielded to keep his crew, generally unhappy and underpaid, in line, a fact that Equiano remarks on, quote, "One white man in particular I saw, when we were permitted to be on deck, flogged so unmercifully with a large rope near the foremast that he died in consequence of it, and they tossed him over the side as they would have done a brute. This made me fear the people the more." What the captain and crew did to the enslaved was far worse. Casual, unrelenting violence reigned from the moment the captives were forced on board until the moment they disembarked. Equiano, like many captives, refused to eat for several days after leaving Africa and was, quote, "hourly whipped for not eating." Those who attempted to throw themselves overboard, preferring death to the hell they were currently enduring, were cut with blades to disable them. One man who managed to get through the nettings and jump into the sea was retrieved by the ship's boat only to be flogged to death to be made an example of. He could die, but only when the captain allowed it. Sexual assault was not just rampant, but institutionalized, as the captain often chose a favorite prisoner for himself for the length of the voyage and distributed access to enslaved women among the crew to incentivize good behavior. Virulent sadism flourished in these conditions. Equiano describes one incident in which the sailors caught more fish than they intended to eat, but rather than giving the extra to the starving captives, they threw the remainder into the sea. This seemingly purposeless violence served to create the racial hierarchy and the distinction between enslaved and enslaver. We don't know how long Equiano spent at sea before he arrived on Barbados. It was probably weeks, but many ships spent months at sea, buffeted by storms and contrary winds, increasing the duration of the journey and the misery of the passengers. In port at Bridgetown, most of the captives were sold to the island's sugar-planting aristocrats, who examined them invasively before purchase. Equiano comments on the inhumanity of the sail yard, where he remembered several brothers being separated from one another after the voyage. Perhaps because of his youth, he was by his reckoning 11 years old, but may have been 8 or 9, Equiano wasn't bought on Barbados. Instead, he was packed onto a sloop bound for Virginia with the remaining captives. After arrival, the rest were sold, leaving only Equiano. Now totally alone and unable to converse with anyone, Equiano was put to work weeding, carrying stones, and fanning his master when he was ill. Several details stuck with him. A watch hanging on the chimney, a portrait whose eyes seemed to follow him across the room, and an enslaved woman who was being forced to wear iron contraptions as a punishment, including one on her head that locked her mouth closed. If not for a stroke of what he considered luck, Equiano might have remained on this Virginia plantation for the rest of his life. A visiting Royal Navy lieutenant named Pascal took a liking to Equiano and bought him for 30 or 40 pounds sterling. Equiano's path back to the sea was now set, a course he would follow for the next three decades. Equiano's new owner, Lieutenant Pascal, brought him onto a ship bound for England. The voyage was long and provisions nearly ran out. The sailors joked that if things got too dire, they would kill, cook, and eat Equiano, a threat the boy took completely seriously. Given what he'd already experienced, why would he think they were joking? Pascal also decided that now was the time to change Equiano's name. He had previously been called Jacob, a label he liked, but Pascal told him his name was now Gustavus Vasa, which he liked less and refused to answer to. Pascal rewarded Equiano with repeated blows until the new name stuck. While in England, Equiano was nearly abducted at swordpoint into service aboard a Royal Navy man of war, separated from several free English children with whom he had bonded, was forced to fight other boys for the entertainment of the sailors on board Lieutenant Pascal's warship, and experienced his first snowfall. It was then the height of the Seven Years' War, perhaps the first truly global conflict in human history. Equiano hunted merchantmen off the coast of France, participated in the siege of Louisbourg in present-day Nova Scotia, fought in a huge naval battle off the coast of Spain, and witnessed the capture of Belle Isle off the coast of Brittany. By the end of the war, he had seen fierce combat, learned to fire the ship's guns, spoke English fluently, and made enough of an impression that his owner's superior officer, a full captain, wanted to buy the boy for himself. Pascal refused all offers. Gustavus Vasa, as he called Equiano, was dear to him, and he wouldn't be parted. Survival in this new world meant that Equiano had to craft a new version of himself, but not without losing all connections to the old. He pined for his long-lost sister. Equiano recounts an incident in which he was told that a sailor knew where his sister was. When he went to investigate, the girl turned out not to be his sibling, leaving Equiano crushed and despondent. Still, the transformation proceeded. Quote, "I now not only felt myself quite easy with these new countrymen, but relished their society and manners. I no longer looked upon them as spirits, but as men superior to us, and therefore I had the stronger desire to resemble them, to imbibe their spirit, and imitate their manners." He converted to Christianity and was baptized in Westminster, and several sisters, the Miss Guerins, taught him further how to read and write. While serving on board a fireship, the Etna, the captain's clerk taught him arithmetic, and another messmate taught him how to read the Bible and shave and style hair. The boy from West Africa was growing up a man of the Atlantic world, a cosmopolitan, well-educated traveler. Despite being enslaved, Equiano did not retreat from life. He chose to embrace the possibilities of this new world, realizing that while escape was impossible and his old life was gone, any chance he had of a better future depended on his wits and work ethic, and no small amount of luck. The relationship between Equiano and Pascal suffered precisely because of this transformation. He thought Pascal a kind, considerate master, as much a father figure as an owner. While Pascal had never explicitly promised Equiano his freedom, he had repeatedly told the boy that he would instruct him in the business of the sea, and that he considered Equiano as free as himself or anyone else on board. But when their ship was due to sail from Portsmouth, Pascal forced Equiano onto the barge at the point of his sword, saying he would cut Equiano's throat with the blade if he ever tried to run away. As soon as they were out of port, Pascal handed over Equiano to the ship's captain, a man named Durand, who made it clear that no matter his past service or what Pascal had told him, Equiano was still a slave. If he didn't behave himself, Durand said, quote, "He had a method on board to make me," Equiano remembers. "I was too well convinced of his power over me to doubt what he said, and my former sufferings in the slave ship presenting themselves to my mind, the recollection of them made me shudder." After yet another Atlantic crossing, Durand sold Equiano to a Quaker named Robert King on the Caribbean island of Montserrat. King was a resident of Philadelphia, and he took his new property with him, telling the now teenaged Equiano that he intended to school him as a clerk for service in his shipping business. Equiano was well aware that this was a much better fate than he might otherwise have suffered. Quote, "I was very grateful to Captain Durand and even to my old master for the character they had given me, a character which I afterwards found of infinite service to me." He had remade himself to survive and thrive, according to the pressures placed upon him by the harsh Atlantic world and the people who dictated its norms, values, and systems. Equiano learned young the value of money and endeavored to hide away as much as he could out of the huge quantities of plunder and prize money the ships he'd served on accumulated during the Seven Years' War. While working for third parties under King's ownership, Equiano was paid. Unlike some enslaved people, he was allowed to keep a portion of that pay, slowly adding to his stash. Equiano fully understood his financial value and that of enslaved labor more generally. At one point, he calculated that he earned King more than 100 pounds a year, more than the merchant paid any of the free clerks in his service. Quote, "I have sometimes heard it asserted that a Negro cannot earn his master the first cost," Equiano wrote, meaning the amount a master paid for an enslaved person. "But nothing can be further from the truth," he finishes. The entire economy of the Atlantic world, from the mid-17th to the mid-19th centuries, was built on the exploitation of enslaved labor and on the valuation of enslaved people as financial assets. No amount of racist or eugenicist nonsense about African phrenology or pandering to the idea of religious salvation could disguise those simple and brutal facts. While working for King, Equiano made trips around the western fringes of the Atlantic world, cataloging the everyday cruelties he witnessed being inflicted on the enslaved people around him. In Montserrat, he saw an African man staked to the ground and cut up piece by piece for the crime of being with a white sex worker. A man who tried to kill his brutal overseer was first hanged and then burned to death. Another, who planned to escape, was tied down and tortured with hot wax. One individual was beaten so badly that all of his bones were broken, simply because a pot had boiled over. Iron muzzles and thumbscrews were so common that Equiano barely felt the need to remark on them. One incident stuck with him, though. On St. Eustatius, Equiano had a dispute with a white man, who believed he could cheat Equiano because of the color of his skin. Equiano argued with him, backed by one of the British sailors aboard ship. The man, quote, went away, however, swearing, and threatened that whenever he caught me on shore, he would shoot me and pay for me afterwards. Nothing can better sum up the racial hierarchy of Equiano's new Atlantic world. A cheating white man could murder an African in a fit of pique and suffer only a financial penalty for abusing or destroying another man's property. For 3 years, this was Equiano's life, and all the while he was hoarding cash to eventually purchase his freedom. By 1766, after still more voyages, he was able to pay King 70 pounds sterling for his manumission. Quote, I thought this was the happiest day I had ever experienced, Equiano writes. He remained in King's service for a freeman as a while, until a trip to Savannah, Georgia, nearly ended with Equiano being abducted and sold into slavery once again. There was no true freedom, he realized, for a black man in the Americas. He was shipwrecked in the Bahamas, rescued, and resolved to leave the New World for good. After one more meeting with his former master King in Montserrat, who gave him a letter of recommendation, Equiano departed the Caribbean for Europe. Now aged around 21, his greatest adventures were still on the horizon. The next 15 years would see Equiano in the Mediterranean, the Atlantic, and even the Arctic, during which voyage he befriended the inventor of the method for distilling seawater. He tried to free an unjustly enslaved African man in the West Indies and was cheated by a ship's captain in Jamaica. By the early 1780s, when he was nearing his 40th birthday, Equiano retired from the seafaring life and settled in London. His Christian faith had grown in its importance in his life, and his extraordinary literacy and eloquence made him an important figure in the emerging abolitionist movement. Equiano's final act of self-making, the composition of his autobiography, was the capstone. He died a prosperous family man in the beating heart of the Atlantic world, London, in 1797, around the age of 52. More than any other individual, Equiano embodies both the possibilities and the perils offered by the 18th century Atlantic, both geographically and mentally. He began his life in Africa and ended it in London. In the years between, he changed his name, his language, and his religion, forging a new person, Olaude Equiano, out of the debris of his circumstances. He wasn't defined by a single location within that Atlantic world, neither his place of birth nor his destination, but by the way each of the places he visited shaped his identity and viewpoint in turn. In experiencing that world, Equiano was transformed, and shows the ways in which he transformed himself. Next time on Past Lives, we'll meet the last person on our first season's journey through more than 2,000 years of slavery, Matilda McCreer, the final survivor of the last known crossing of the Middle Passage to the United States. Thanks so much for joining me, and I look forward to chatting with you again. If you haven't already, please subscribe to our Patreon linked in the description. It's only $7 a month, and you get access to tons of bonus content, like interviews with great scholars, Q&As with me, our book club, and much more. You can follow me on Instagram at Wyman_Patrick or on Blue Sky at Patrick Wyman. Past Lives is a 100% independent production, and your support is what allows us to make this show. So, thank you. Past Lives is written and narrated by me, Patrick Wyman. The producer is Morgan Jaffe. The music and sound design is by Gabriel Gould. The story editor is Rachel Cambori. Until next time, this has been Past Lives.